My cubby wasn't registered in the Hive zoning schematic as an apartment. I'd taken over a renovated warehouse loft from a friend of mine who'd run afoul of loan sharks. My friend had decided late in life to emigrate to one of the outback colonies, and I'd gotten a good deal on a place just a click down the corridor from my office. The environment was a little rough, and sometimes the noise from the loading docks could drown out conversation, but it gave me 10 times the room of a normal cubby, and I could use my weights and workout equipment right at home. Johnny honestly seemed intrigued by the place, and I had to kick myself for being pleased. Next thing you knew, I'd be putting on lipstick and body rouge for this cybrid. "So, why do you live on Lussis?" I asked him. "Most off-worlders find the gravity a pain and the scenery monotonous. Plus, your research materials at the library on Renaissance V. Why here?" I found myself looking and listening very carefully as he answered. His hair was straight on top, parted in the middle, and fell in reddish-brown curls to his collar. He had the habit of resting his cheek on his fist as he spoke. It struck me that his dialect was actually the non-dialect of someone who has learned a new language perfectly, but without the lazy shortcuts of someone born to it. And beneath that, there was a hint of lilt that brought back the overtones of a cat burglar I'd known who had grown up on Asquith, a quiet backwater web world settled by first-expansion immigrants from what had once been the British Isles. "I have lived on many worlds," he said. "My purpose is to observe." "As a poet?" He shook his head, winced, and gingerly touched the stitches. "No, I'm not a poet. He was." Despite the circumstances, there was an energy and vitality to Johnny that I'd found in too few men. It was hard to describe, but I'd seen rooms full of more important personages rearrange themselves to orbit around personalities like his. It was not merely his reticence and sensitivity. It was an intensity that he emanated even when merely observing. "Why do you live here?" he asked. "I was born here." "Yes, but you spent your childhood years on Tau Ceti Center. Your father was a senator." I said nothing. "Many people expected you to go into politics," he said. "Did your father's suicide dissuade you?"
"It wasn't suicide," I said.
"No?"
"All the news reports and the inquest said it was," I said tonelessly. "But they were wrong. My father never would have taken his own life."
"So it was murder?"
"Yes."
"Despite the fact that there was no motive or hint of a suspect?"
"Yes."
"I see," said Johnny.
The yellow glow from the loading dock lamps came through the dusty windows and made his hair gleam like new copper.
"Do you like being a detective?"
"When I do it well," I said. "Are you hungry?"
"No."
"Then let's get some sleep. You can have the couch."
"Do you do it well often?" he said. "Being a detective?"
"We'll see tomorrow." In the morning, Johnny forecast to Renaissance Vector at about the usual time, waited a moment in the plaza, and then cast to the old Settlers Museum on Sol Draconi Septim. From there, he jumped to the main Terminex on Nordholm, and then cast to the Templar world of God's Grove. We'd worked out the timing ahead of time, and I was waiting for him on Renaissance V, standing back in the shadows of the colonnade. A man with a queue was the third through after Johnny. There was no doubt he was Lussian. Between the hive pallor, the muscle and body mass, and the arrogant way of walking, he might have been my long-lost brother. He never looked at Johnny, but I could tell that he was surprised when the cybrid circled around to the outbound portals. I stayed back and only caught a glimpse of his card, but would have bet anything that it was a tracer. Q was careful in the old settler's museum, keeping Johnny in sight, but checking his own back as well. I was dressed in a Zen Gnostics meditation jumper, isolation visor and all, and I never looked their way as I circled to the museum outportal and cast directly to God's Grove. It made me feel funny leaving Johnny alone through the museum and Nordholm Terminex, but both were public places and it was a calculated risk. Johnny came through the World Tree arrival portal right on time and bought a ticket for the tour. His shadow had to scurry to catch up, breaking cover to board the omnibus skimmer before it left. I was already settled in the rear seat on the upper deck, and Johnny found a place near the front just as we had planned. Now I was wearing basic tourist garb, and my imager was one of a dozen in action when Q hurried to take his place three rows behind Johnny. The tour of World Tree is always fun. Dad first took me there when I was only 3 standard. But this time, as the skimmer moved above branches the size of freeways and circled higher around a trunk the width of Olympus Mons, I found myself reacting to the glimpses of hooded Templars with something approaching anxiety. Johnny and I had discussed various clever and infinitely subtle ways to trail Q if he showed up, to follow him to his lair and spend weeks, if necessary, deducing his game. In the end, I opted for something less than the subtle approach. The omnibus had dumped us out near the Muir Museum, and people were milling around on the plaza, torn between spending 10 marks for a ticket to educate themselves or going straight for the gift shop, when I walked up to Q, gripped him by the upper arm, and said in conversational tones, "Hi. Do you mind telling me what the fuck you want with my client?" There's an old stereotype that says that Lussians are as subtle as a stomach pump and about half as pleasant. If I'd helped confirm the first part of that, Q went a long way toward reinforcing the second prejudice. He was fast. Even with my seemingly casual grip paralyzing the muscles of his right arm, the knife in his left hand sliced up and around in less than a second. I let myself fall to my right, the knife slicing air centimeters from my cheek, hitting pavement and rolling as I palmed the neural stunner and came up on one knee to meet the threat. No threat. Q was running. Away from me. Away from Johnny. He shoved tourists aside, dodged behind them, moving toward the museum entrance. I slid the stunner back into its wristband and began running myself. Stunners are great close-range weapons, as easy to aim as a shotgun without the dire effects if the spread pattern finds innocent bystanders, but they aren't worth anything beyond 8 or 10 meters. On full dispersal, I could give half the tourists in the plaza a miserable headache, but Q was already too far away to bring down. I ran after him. Johnny ran toward me. I waved him back. "My place," I shouted. "Use the locks!" Q had reached the museum entrance, and now he looked back at me. The knife was still in his hand. I charged at him, feeling something like joy at the thought of the next few minutes. Q vaulted a turnstile and shoved tourists aside to get through the doors. I followed. It was only when I reached the vaulted interior of the Grand Hall and saw him shoving his way up the crowded escalator to the excursion mezzanine that I realized where he was headed. My father had taken me on the Templar excursion when I was 3. The Farcaster portals were permanently open. It took about 3 hours to walk all the guided tours on the 30 worlds where the Templar ecologists had preserved some bit of nature which they thought would please the Muir. I couldn't remember for sure, but I thought the paths were loop trails with the portals relatively close together for easy transit by Templar guides and maintenance people. Shit. A uniformed guard near the tour portal saw the confusion as Q cut through and stepped forward to intercept the rude intruder. Even from 15 meters away, I could see the shock and disbelief on the old guard's face as he staggered backward, the hilt of Q's long knife protruding from his chest. The old guard, probably a retired local cop, looked down, face white, touched the bone hilt gingerly as if it were a gag, and collapsed face first on the mezzanine tiles. Tourists screamed. Someone yelled for a medic. I saw Q shove a Templar guide aside and throw himself through the glowing portal. This was not going as I'd planned. I vaulted for the portal without slowing. Through and half-sliding on the slippery grass of a hillside. Sky lemon-yellow above us. Tropical scents. I saw startled faces turned my way. Q was halfway to the other Farcaster, cutting through elaborate flower beds and kicking aside bonsai topiary. I recognized the world of Fuji and careened down the hillside, clambering uphill again through the flower beds, following the trail of destruction Q had left. "Stop that man!" I screamed, realizing how foolish it sounded. No one made a move, except for a Nipponese tourist who raised her imager and recorded a sequence. Q looked back, shoved past a gawking tour group, and stepped through the Farcast portal. I had the stunner in my hand again and waved it at the crowd. "Back! Back!" They hastily made room. I went through warily, stunner raised. Q no longer had his knife, but I didn't know what other toys he carried. Brilliant light on water. The violet waves of Mare Infinitus. The path was a narrow wooden walkway 10 meters above the support floats. It led out and away, curving above a fairyland coral reef and a sargasso of yellow island kelp before curving back, but a narrow catwalk cut across to the portal at the end of the trail. Q had climbed the no-access gate and was halfway across the catwalk. I ran the 10 paces to the edge of the platform, selected tight beam, and held the stunner on full auto, sweeping the invisible beam back and forth as if I were aiming a garden hose. Q seemed to stumble a half-step, but then made the last 10 meters to the portal and dived through. I cursed and climbed the gate, ignoring shouts from a Templar guide behind me. I caught a glimpse of a sign which reminded tourists to don therm gear, and then I was through the portal, barely sensing the shower-tingle sensation of passing through the Farcaster screen. A blizzard roared, whipping against the arched containment field, which turned the tourist trail into a tunnel through fierce whiteness. Sol Draconi Septim. The northern reaches, where Templar lobbying of the All-Thing had stopped the colonial heating project in order to save the Arctic wraiths. I could feel the 1.7 standard gravity on my shoulders, like the yoke of my workout machine. It was a shame that Q was a Lussian also. If he'd been Webb standard in physique, there would have been no contest if I caught him here. Now we would see who was in better shape. Q was 50 meters down the trail and looking back over his shoulder. The other Farcaster was somewhere near, but the blizzard made anything off the trail invisible and inaccessible. I began loping after him. In deference to the gravity, this was the shortest of the Templar excursion trails, curving back after only 200 or so meters. I could hear Q's panting as I closed on him. I was running easily. There was no way that he was going to beat me to the next Farcaster. I saw no tourists on the trail, and so far no one had given chase. I thought that this would not be a bad place to interrogate him. Q was 30 meters short of the exit portal when he turned, dropped to one knee, and aimed an energy pistol. The first bolt was short, possibly because of the unaccustomed weight of the weapon in Sol Draconi's gravity field, but it was close enough to leave a scorched slash of slagged walkway and melted permafrost to within a meter of me. He adjusted his aim. I went out through the containment field, shouldering my way through the elastic resistance and stumbling into drifts above my waist. The cold air burned my lungs, and wind-driven snow caked my face and bare arms in seconds. I could see Q looking for me from within the lighted pathway, but the blizzard dimness worked in my favor now as I threw myself through drifts in his direction. Q Q forced his head, shoulders, and right arm through the field wall, squinting in the barrage of icy particles which coated his cheeks and brow in an instant. His second shot was high, and I felt the heat of the bolt as it passed over. I was within 10 meters of him now. I set the stunner on widest dispersal and sprayed it in his direction without lifting my head from the snowdrift where I had dropped. Q let the energy pistol tumble into the snow and fell back through the containment field. I screamed in triumph, my shout lost in the wind roar, and staggered toward the field wall. My hands and feet were distant things now, beyond the pain of cold. My cheeks and ears burned. I put the thought of frostbite out of my mind and threw myself against the field. It was a Class 3 field, designed to keep out the elements and anything as huge as an Arctic wraith, while allowing the occasional errant tourist or errand-bent Templar re-entry to the path. But in my cold-weakened condition, I found myself batting against it for half a moment like a fly against plastic, my feet slipping on snow and ice. Finally, I threw myself forward, landing heavily and clumsily, dragging my legs through. The sudden warmth of the pathway set me to shaking uncontrollably. Shards of sleet fell from me as I forced myself to my knees, then to my feet. Q ran the last 5 yards to the exit portal with his right arm dangling as if broken. I knew the nerve-fire agony of a neural stunner and did not envy him. He looked back once as I began running toward him, and then he went through. Maui Covenant. The air was tropical and smelled of ocean and vegetation. The sky was an old earth blue. I saw immediately that the trail had led to one of the few free modal isles which the Templars had saved from hegemony domestication. It was a large isle, perhaps half a kilometer from end to end, and from the access portal's vantage point, on a wide deck encircling the main treesail trunk, I could see the expansive sail leaves filling with wind and the indigo rudder vines trailing far behind. The exit portal lay only 15 meters away, down a staircase, but I saw at once that Q had run the other way, along the main trail toward a cluster of huts and concession stands near the edge of the isle. It was only here, halfway along the Templar excursion trail, that they allowed human structures to shelter weary hikers while they purchased refreshments or souvenirs to benefit the Templar Brotherhood. I began jogging down the wide staircase to the trail below, still shivering, my clothes soaked with rapidly melting snow. Why was Q running toward the cluster of people there? I saw the bright carpets laid out for rental and understood. The hawking mats were illegal on most web worlds, but still a tradition on Maui Covenant because of the Siri legend. Less than 2 meters long and a meter wide, the ancient playthings lay waiting to carry tourists out over the sea and back again to the Wandering Isle. If Q reached one of those... I broke into a full sprint, catching the other Lussian a few meters short of the hawking mat area and tackling him just below the knees. We rolled into the concession stand area, and the few tourists there shouted and scattered. My father taught me one thing which any child ignores at his or her own peril. A good big guy can always beat a good little guy. In this case, we were about even. Q twisted free and jumped to his feet, falling into an arms-out, finger-splayed oriental fighting stance. Now we'd see who the better guy was. Q got the first blow in, feinting a straight-fingered jab with his left hand, and coming up and around with a swinging kick instead. I ducked, but he connected solidly enough to make my left shoulder and upper arm go numb. Q danced backward. I followed. He swung a close-fisted right-handed punch. I blocked it. He chopped with his left hand. I blocked with my right forearm. Q danced back, whirled, and unleashed a left-footed kick. I ducked, caught his leg as it passed over, and dumped him on the sand. Q jumped up. I knocked him down with a short left hook. He rolled away and scrambled to his knees. I kicked him behind his left ear, pulling the blow enough to leave him conscious. Too conscious, I realized a second later, as he ran four fingers under my guard in an attempted heart jab. Instead, he bruised the layers of muscle under my right breast. I punched him full force in the mouth, sending blood spraying as he rolled to the waterline and lay still. Behind us, people ran toward the exit portal, calling to the few others to get the police. I lifted Johnny's would-be assassin by his cue, dragged him to the edge of the aisle, and dipped his face in the water until he came to. Then I rolled him over and lifted him by his torn and stained shirt front. We would have only a minute or two until someone arrived. Q stared up at me with a glazed glare. I shook him once and leaned close.
"Listen, my friend," I whispered. "We're going to have a short but sincere conversation. We'll start with who you are and why you're bothering the guy you were following."
I felt the surge of current before I saw the blue. I cursed and let go of his shirt front. The electrical nimbus seemed to surround Q's entire body at once. I jumped back, but not before my own hair stood on end and surge control alarms on my comm log chirped urgently. Q opened his mouth to scream, and I could see the blue within like a poorly done hollow special effect. His shirt front sizzled, blackened, and burst into flame. Beneath it, his chest grew blue spots like an ancient film burning through. The spots widened, joined, widened again. I looked into his chest cavity and saw organs melting in blue flame. He screamed again, audibly this time, and I watched as teeth and eyes collapsed into blue fire. I took another step back. Q was burning now, the orange-red flame superseding the blue glow. His flesh exploded outward with flame as if his bones had ignited. Within a minute, he was a smoking caricature of charred flesh, the body reduced to the ancient dwarf boxer posture of burning victims everywhere. I turned away and put a hand over my mouth, searching the faces of the few watchers to see if any of them could have done this. Wide, frightened eyes stared back. Far above, gray security uniforms burst from the Farcaster.
"Damn!"
I looked around. The tree sails surged and billowed overhead. Radiant gossamers, beautiful even in daylight, flitted among tropical vegetation of 100 hues. Sunlight danced on blue ocean. The way to both portals was blocked. The security guard leading the group had drawn a weapon. I was to the first hawking mat in three strides, trying to remember from my one ride 2 decades earlier how the flight threads were activated. I tapped designs in desperation. The hawking mat went rigid and lifted 10 centimeters off the beach. I could hear the shouts now as security guards reached the edge of the crowd. A woman in gaudy Renaissance minor garb pointed my way. I jumped off the hawking mat, gathered up the other 7 mats, and jumped aboard my own. Barely able to find the flight designs under the tumble of rugs, I slapped the forward controls until the mat lurched into flight, almost tumbling me off as it rose. 50 meters out, 30 meters high, I dumped the other mats into the sea and swiveled to see what was happening on the beach. Several gray uniforms were huddled around the burned remains. Another pointed a silver wand in my direction. Delicate needles of pain tingled along my arm, shoulders, and neck. My eyelids drooped, and I almost slid off the mat to my right. I gripped the far side with my left hand, slumped forward, and tapped at the ascent design with fingers made of wood. Climbing again, I fumbled at my right sleeve for my own stunner. The wristband was empty. A minute later, I sat up and shook off most of the effects of the stun, although my fingers still burned and I had a fierce headache. The modal aisle was far behind, shrinking more each second. A century ago, the island would have been driven by the bands of dolphins brought here originally during the Hegira, but the Hegemony Pacification Program during the Siri Rebellion had killed off most of the aquatic mammals, and now the islands wandered listlessly, carrying their cargo of web tourists and resort owners. I checked the horizons for another island, a hint of one of the rare mainlands. Nothing. Or, rather, blue sky, endless ocean, and soft brushstrokes of clouds far to the west. Or was it to the east? I pulled my comm log off my belt lock and keyed in general datasphere access, then stopped. If the authorities had chased me this far, the next step would be to pinpoint my location and send out a skimmer or security EMV. I wasn't sure if they could trace my comm log when I logged in, but I saw no reason to help them. I thumbed the comm link on standby and looked around again. Good move, Brawn. Poking along at 200 meters on a 3-century-old hawking mat with who knows how many, or how few, hours of charge in its flight threads, possibly 1,000 clicks or more from land of any sort, and lost. Great. I crossed my arms and sat back to think. Emlamia? Johnny's soft voice almost made me jump off the mat. Johnny? I stared at the comm log. It was still on standby. The general comm frequency indicator was dark. Johnny, is that you? Of course. I thought you'd never turn your comm log on. How did you trace me? What band are you calling on? Never mind that. Where are you headed? I laughed and told him that I didn't have the slightest idea. Can you help? Wait. There was the briefest second of pause. All right. I have you on one of the weather mapping sats. A terribly primitive thing. Good thing your hawking mat has a passive transponder. I stared at the rug that was the only thing between me and a long, loud fall to the sea. It does? Can the others track me? They could, said Johnny, but I'm jamming this particular signal. Now, where do you want to go? Home. I'm not sure if that's wise after the death of... our suspect. I squinted, suddenly suspicious. How do you know about that? I didn't say anything. Be serious, Emlamia. The security bands are full of it on 6 worlds. They have a reasonable description of you. Shit! Precisely. Now, where would you like to go? Where are you? I asked. My place? No, I left there when the security bands mentioned you. I'm near a forecaster. That's where I need to be. I looked around again. Ocean, sky, a hint of clouds. At least no fleets of EMVs. All right, said Johnny's disembodied voice. There's a powered-down force multi-portal less than 10 clicks from your present location. I shielded my eyes and rotated 360 degrees. The hell there is, I said. I don't know how far away the horizon is on this world, but it's at least 40 clicks, and I can't see anything. Submersible base, said Johnny. Hang on, I'm going to take control. The hawking mat lurched again, dipped once, and then fell steadily. I held on with both hands and resisted the urge to scream. Submersible? I called against the windrush. How far? Do you mean how deep? Yeah. 8 fathoms. I converted the archaic units to meters. This time, I did scream. That's almost 14 meters underwater. Where else do you expect a submersible to be? What the hell do you expect me to do? Hold my breath? The ocean rushed toward me. Not necessary, said my comm log. The hawking mat has a primitive crash field. It should easily hold for a mere 8 fathoms. Please hang on. I hung on.